Hi, welcome to another Writers After Dark. I'm Summer Brooks, and we are here because good stories start with the writers, because wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. And with me today is Sean Hamill, the author of A Cosmology of Monsters, a dark fantasy, shall we say, coming-of-age, monster-taming exploration into the connections between monsters, madness, family, and confronting some hard truths. Did I get that right, Sean?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that. That sounds good. thank you so much for having me.
Oh, welcome, welcome. This is people kept calling it a horror story, but I see this more of a dark coming-of-age story where instead of battling external monsters, most of the battles are with the monsters you grew up with that you didn't realize were monsters.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think horror is sort of a broad category that actually can encompass, you know, I'm off on a bad foot here. Horror, I think of as a subset of fantasy, right? And so I would agree with that assessment of it as more of a dark fantasy than a horror novel. And much the same way that I feel like a lot of weird fiction, you know, and cosmic horror is less about, you know, scaring the pants off you and more about sort of creating a sense of dread or dark wonder. And then my take on it was to sort of add the, I guess, the domestic side to the cosmic, you know, with family and coming of age and sexual awakening and all of that, if that makes any sense.
In terms of the story, yes, you have sort of a love story between a set of parents, the, shall we say, the crumbling of the cohesiveness of the family, the mental and emotional stability of that family when certain bad things happen. And you've got little Noah, well, mostly little Noah.
Right.
exploring, questioning what he has come to. I'm trying really not to spoil this. What he's come to understand as his normal is not considered normal because his family has a history with monsters and certain manifestations of those monsters. And I mean, his parents fell in love with Lovecraft. They fell in love with each other over their discussions of Lovecraft, I guess you could call it. And I really am trying to avoid. Okay. One thing we can talk about is, did the parents invite the monsters in with their love story, or were they just always there?
I think that on Harry's side, they were always there. Because when you get a little bit into his backstory with his mother a little bit later in the book and towards the very end, there are a couple of big drops in the last couple of pages that I won't give away for anybody who hasn't read the book. But you see that his side of the family sort of had a connection with this other world, with these creatures. And Margaret, Noah's mother, sort of marries into it, I guess, and becomes a part of it sort of unwittingly. And I don't think that that Harry, the father, is necessarily consciously aware. You know, it's not like he's doing something deliberately or deliberately hiding something. It's more like there's something the way it is with, I think, a lot of mental illness, and the way mental illness was earlier in the 20th century, too, before, you know, we got a lot better at recognizing it and treating it, sort of something that ripples under the surface that can be felt, but you might have a hard time explaining. So I, that's sort of my take on it. Although, you know, I one of the things that happened in the editing process of the book was we actually pulled back on more explicit answers for some of that stuff, because it sort of helped the atmosphere of the story to leave it a little bit more mysterious. But that's sort of my take on it.
And even today, with a slightly better understanding of how some mental illnesses work, would he have been able to explain that in a way that Margaret would have understood? Or, you know, was he just playing around? Did he just have a vivid imagination? Who could be expected to believe that his situation was actually, or could have been, described as real?
I think that particular situation you'd have a hard time explaining, no matter when. Actually, maybe even a harder time in modern day than you would, you know, 300, 400 years ago, whenever, you know, people thought that, you know, demons walked the earth, you know, just to screw with people, and they burned people at the stake for it. So I don't think, even if his parents fell in love today, that Harry, because I don't think Harry was completely aware of it, of that piece of his family legacy. I think it, you can sort of see him when he talks about his mother sort of struggling to understand or explain it a little bit. And he doesn't really understand it either. Like, he can speak to the fact that his mother is mentally ill, but he can't speak to this other thing. This bigger thing that she talks to Margaret about a little bit whenever Harry, when the family cohesion, as you put it, starts to sort of deteriorate, she sort of tells Margaret a little bit about, you know, finding out that she was schizophrenic, and the things that, like, she started to think and experience. And so I think it's something that's where the cosmic end of it comes from, right? Because I think a lot of cosmic horror is about things that are a little too big to wrap our minds around. And that's where, you know, the scariness in weird fiction comes from, is this thing that you cannot understand completely as a human being that has control over the universe that you occupy.
Yeah, sort of a willful blindness to the fact that so much in life, in the world, in the universe, in the cosmos, is not only beyond your control, but in many cases will always be beyond your comprehension. And dealing with the effects of how small and insignificant that can make you feel could in itself drive people crazy. Some people.
Yeah. I think so. I you know, there's a, you know, this thing I paraphrase from Kierkegaard in the book about the real societal taboo on suicide has to do with its unhealthiness for the society, not just for the individual. Because if someone you care about takes their life or decides that it's meaningless or whatever and ends it, what's to stop other people from looking that far inward or outward and making that same decision instead of moving forward or putting those blinders on? So, yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
So where did the seeds of this story come from? What inspired you or sparked you to choose this story as one to tell?
Well, this project was sort of born out of a couple of different, the flaming wrecks of a couple of other projects. The first was a novel that I had kind of tried to start writing in my early 20s. I kind of wanted to do a big family saga novel, like, Jonathan Franzen or John Irving or Meg Wolitz, or, big sprawling decade spanning, and my original idea was that it would be about a family running a youth hostel in New Mexico, because once I went to a youth hostel in New Mexico and I thought, oh, this would be an interesting idea for a book. But the novel I could never really get off the ground because I'd never worked at a youth hostel. I'd only been the one time and spent a weekend there. So, like, there wasn't enough material for a book there. And the other piece of it was a short story, which was the first thing I turned in for workshop in my MFA program, which was about this married couple who've broken up because the husband has found out that he has a brain tumor and has basically abandoned the family to go work in a haunted house because he's like, screw it, I'm going to die in a few months. I might as well enjoy myself. And his wife has basically come to try and convince him to come die at home with the family. And it's them sort of touring this haunted house and arguing. And my professor didn't like the story very much. He was really against the the haunted house elements. What he told me was, keep the cancer but lose the haunted house, have him build a boat or something instead. Which I didn't take that advice, but I think what he was getting at was that the story was really mean. He didn't care about the characters. Like, they weren't very, it was, they were hard to root for, and that indirectly, I think that's kind of what he was getting at, was he didn't believe that these people ever loved each other, that they loved their kids, any of that. I'd pushed too hard in terms of how ugly can I make this. And so, I'm walking around, walking my dog one day after, my professor has just trashed this story, and rightfully so. But, I'm sort of at a loss for how to fix it. And then suddenly I remember the family business idea. And the two kind of just collided, and I realized, oh, the family business should be a haunted house. And it just kind of grew organically from there. Originally, it was supposed to be a very naturalist novel that would deal with horror in a metaphorical way, but the actual monsters then kind of started inviting themselves in as I continued to tell the story, and it just sort of grew and evolved in these really interesting ways. I could never have planned this book because it really, every surprise in the book was sort of a surprise to me. And part of the delight of writing it, but also what made it so difficult to write, was sort of following that story where it went. And sometimes I ended up down blind alleys, but other times when the surprise worked, that's the stuff that made it into the final published version. So it was, it's not a book that I had. It's sort of a book that I stumbled into rather than one that I meticulously planned. And hopefully some of that sort of sense of wonder transfers over to the reader as well and keeps them sort of on their toes and surprised in a good way without it feeling too picaresque or diffuse. It's, hopefully it's got some cohesion for the reader at the end.
So it's safe to say that this could be considered a pantser masterpiece.
Yeah, I guess so. If you want, if you want to use the word masterpiece, I'll take it.
It's a truly engaging story, and you do, even if you don't agree with some of the character choices, you see where they're coming from. You understand some of what they're going through, even if they don't understand why they're going through it. Again, trying to avoid spoilers.
Sure.
It is a easy to read, but hard to completely grasp all the elements of, 'cause you're reading because you want to get through the story, and then there's just so much happening along the side, and you go, wait, what did I just miss? but it is a languorous, imaginative tale, almost in a dreamlike setting. Some of the, especially the early romance parts between Harry and Margaret, and just Margaret exploring what she can do, what she wants to do. She still doesn't know herself completely when she starts going through all these choices, you know, getting married, haunted house building, finding a footing for her family. And there's just so much there to unpack. And it's, you know, it's a life. It's lives colliding. And oh yeah, monsters.
Yeah. Which, you know, which I guess, you know, hopefully, you know, you come for the monsters and stay for the family, right?
That was, or sort of my... the other way around could work too.
Yep. That's true. That's true. Depends, I guess, on what your usual reading fare is. And that was sort of my fear, actually, whenever I, when I finished the book and my agent first started getting ready to submit it to publishers, I remember talking to my wife and just being so convinced the book was never going to sell because it was, you know, too much of a family book to be a horror novel. And it was a little too genre and weird to be like just a, you know, a standard family novel. But it seems to have carved out a nice space for itself, you know, with readers over the last year or so, and which has been immensely gratifying. You know, obviously no book is for everybody, but it does definitely seem to be finding its readers, the people who want that sort of liminal space, which is where a lot of my favorite fiction tends to live, between, you know, genre and literary, or you know, easy to read but hard, like you said, hard to grasp in its entirety in one go, type of stories. So thank you for saying all of that and for picking up on it.
Well, like I said, yeah, in the past year, the book came out in hardcover about a year ago, and it just now came out in trade paperback, I believe.
Yeah, just last month, August 4th.
Yeah, and it seems like from the feedback that of people who have read it, they enjoy it quite a bit. There's a lot of positive buzz over the past year, so that must be a little bit of a breather, a sigh of relief for you.
Yeah, definitely. I've been very fortunate in terms of my interactions with readers so far. Although I'll know I've really made it whenever, you know, trolls start coming for me online. but that hasn't happened yet. And for the most part, people reaching out have, you know, both domestic and international, because the foreign editions have started to hit. And everybody who's bothered to reach out to me on social media or whatever has been just so kind. And, you know, it is an immense relief to find that there is an audience for this story, you know, just like my agent thought there was, and just like my editors thought there would be. And that, you know, it might not be, you know, burning the world down, but it's not really designed to be a book for the entire world. It's a book that's intensely for the people that it's for, and not for the people, you know what I mean? Like it's a book that I'm hoping inspires, you know, either avid love or intense distaste, I guess.
Well, you said the fans who have been reaching out to you, finding the book to thank you for the story. What have you seen many of them grasping onto? The way you handled the family, the way you handled Noah, the way you handled mental illness, or just the approach to the monsters being different?
I think the thing people have responded to most is the emotional stuff in the book. So the family material and the depictions of mental illness, as well as, you know, the way the book touches, not too heavily, but, you know, one of the main characters is gay growing up in, you know, the suburbs of Fort Worth in the 1990s, which was maybe better than growing up gay in the 60s or 70s, but still it wasn't the most friendly place to grow up gay. And I've also, a lot of the people I've heard from have really liked that character, and who is my favorite character in the book as well. And that was something I hadn't really thought about beforehand. Like, it just was something that sort of naturally grew out of the character. I didn't design it to be sort of, you know, it's all pantsing. Like, it developed organically, but it's been this really lovely thing to hear from readers that even though I myself am not, you know, gay, that I seem to have been able to represent some of that coming of age experience in a way that felt real to them and moving to them, which was something that I'm, you know, always incredibly nervous about whenever I'm writing about, you know, something that's not from my own, you know, straight white male point of view. So to hear that in particular, and that was something I was expecting to hear from people about the mental illness and stuff, because that's all very close to home for me as far as my own life. But that other piece, the LGBTQ piece, has been just a real delight and sort of a, I don't know. It's been lovely, I guess. I can't think of any other way to put it or some way to put a cap on that thought.
Well, the like I said, the writing in some spaces is almost lyrical, poetic, and I think that adds to some of the connection with the family, despite the problems they're having. When you were writing this, were there any surprises that came up? Because you said you mostly pants this. Was there anything that sort of revealed itself to you in a way you totally were not expecting?
Yeah, I guess the biggest surprise to me as I was sort of fumbling my way into this book was those lyrical passages you talk about, which to me, you say that and I think about the interludes between the sections, which are the only time in the book you're not directly hearing from Noah, right? That they're the Turner sequence. So each one of those kind of gives you a look into the minds of another member of the family. And that was something that I wasn't planning on, but as I sort of knew between so the book sort of is bifurcated. I mean, it's split into several different times, but there's a early section, which is told mostly from Margaret's point of view before Noah is born. And then there's the stuff after Noah is born, which is the rest of the book. And I knew that there was going to be a time jump of several years between the last section from Margaret's point of view and the first section that's entirely from Noah's point of view. And I knew I had a lot of information I had to get across. And I had a lot of ground to cover, and I needed a way to do it that was quick and efficient. You know, the novelists that I mentioned earlier, you know, people like John Irving can somehow stretch, you know, can write across decades and make it feel seamless. But I didn't know how to do that. I'm very much a scene focused writer. And you know, this was kind of my first novel. So, you know, I'm still learning the craft, but so I started kind of playing with this idea. The first one of these sequences that I wrote was the one with Sydney, the oldest sister, which is the one that takes place after, after the big turn at the end of the second section before Noah is born, and then sort of jumps forward 6 years to Noah being 6 years old. And it really surprised me in how immediate the emotion of it was. And I felt like I suddenly unlocked a very important piece of the book, because in a lot of ways, this is a story about a family that doesn't know how to talk to each other. You know, they're all keeping secrets from each other. They're all sort of hiding or lying. And suddenly I was able to be completely honest from Sydney's point of view, just all of that rage, all of that sadness, all of that frustration, all of that fear. And to sort of wrap it in this very lyrical, dreamlike prose, and then understanding like, oh, I can do this for every single member of the family, and sort of get directly at what's eating each and every one of them that Noah might not even know about at that point in the story. So it's a way to give the reader information that Noah doesn't even have. And that really was a gift that I guess from the ether, from Cthulhu, from my subconscious, whatever you want to call it, because it enabled me to have this novel about a family that in some ways is kind of cold to each other. You know, Margaret, especially as she gets older for a while, becomes a colder and colder presence in the book. So having a way to get at the actual warmth underneath that iciness, the things that they're afraid to tell each other, but that they do feel, you know, that does a lot of the emotional lifting of the book. And that also conclude, you know, there's the book concludes on one of those sections without giving too much away. And that final section, which is when you finally get into Harry's head, I guess, spoiler alert, you might put a mild spoiler alert on this episode of the book, since it's so hard to talk about. That was an honest surprise. I didn't know until I sat down. I thought I had finished the book, and then I realized, like, no, there's still this other piece that needs to be told. And once I wrote it, that sort of tied it all together, because for a long time, I was thinking I was going to have to cut the early sections of the book about Margaret, because that's what my MFA thesis advisor was telling me to do. Thank God I didn't take that advice. But but when I wrote that ending, I was like, oh, here it is. This brings it all together. It brings it all full circle. And I'm going to get to keep all this stuff that I love that I was afraid was going to get relegated to, you know, just like, I don't know, you know, just a file on my computer out in the cloud somewhere forever.
Cool. Well, I do recommend people check this story out. Is there an audiobook version of this too?
Yeah. It's on all the major audiobook retailers. It's actually read by Sean Patrick Hopkins. So it's another Sean who reads it, and he does a really great job.
Awesome. Well, what else are you working on that you can talk about safely?
Without, I guess, giving too much away, I've got a short story in an anthology that'll be hitting around Halloween. I'm not allowed to talk about what it is yet, I don't think, but I'm very excited about it. So, you know, if you follow me on social media at all, like the second I'm allowed to talk about it, I promise I won't shut up about it for a while. But it should be easily accessible to just about anyone once it hits. And I'm very excited to share that, because it'll be the first thing since Cosmology that will be coming out. And I also just finished the first draft of what I'm hoping will be my next book. And, you know, it's funny, you started the conversation talking about dark fantasy, because this book definitely leans a lot harder into the fantasy elements than it does horror. I mean, there's still a little bit, you know, there's still monsters, but it's really more about friendship. You know, if Cosmology was about family, this one I think is about friendship, and what that looks like over 20, 30 years, instead of what it looks like to be in a family for 20, 30 years and growing up in, you know, a small town and sort of leaning a bit more into the fantastic, the magical, but still with a tinge of darkness. So hopefully fans of Cosmology will recognize that flavor and will enjoy it. I'm very excited about it. I mean, I just finished it last Wednesday. So like this is brand new. I'm just starting to, so I pantsed this book like Cosmology, but now I'm going back and sort of outlining based on the first draft and sort of, and this is what I had to do with Cosmology too, because the first draft of Cosmology was 220,000 words, which is about twice the published length. The final book is 100,000 words, just over. So there was a lot of that's the thing about pantsing, right? Or at least it is for me, is I write really long, really big, and then I pare it down. Luckily, this first draft wasn't nearly that big. It's only 147,000. I think I'm taking some of the lessons from cosmology into this book, hopefully, in terms of pacing and length. And I'm sure that if, I end up getting to publish it, that my agents and editor will help me get it, at a pretty good pace as well. I'm hoping. I'm trying to get it there myself, but I'm sure they'll, do what they always do, just say nice try, and then tell me how to actually do it, which is fine because that's what they're there to do.
So what appeals to you more, writing the longer form stories or short stories, or is there really not that big of a difference to you? It just matters what the story requires.
I tend to think in longer narratives. I like narratives that span a lot of time. I think the novel is my sort of natural habitat as a writer, so to speak. And in fact, the short story that's coming started life as what I was hoping was going to be. I wrote it between drafts of Cosmology, hoping it was going to be my next book, but it didn't quite work out, and I actually found a really good short story in the midst of sort of the wreckage. A lot of my best stuff also seems to come from the wreckage of other projects. So, I guess to any writers out there, save it all because you don't know what you might find later. But yeah, I short stories have always been difficult for me for whatever reason. And I always admire writers, like Alice Munro, who can do an entire lifetime's worth of narrative in a 20-page story or whatever, or who can write with such immediacy that the short story is the perfect form for, the tale that they're trying to tell. But for me, I really like to see how people's relationships grow and change and get better and worse over time. And that really seems to be the engine firing, my imagination. But hopefully the short story will work for people, and hopefully it won't be the last one I write, because it once I realized, oh, here's a short story, I was very pleased with it. So hopefully it won't be the only, hopefully I'll find others along the way as I work between novels.
Cool. Well, we will keep an eye out for any other projects you're promoting and excited about, and definitely let us know about that short story. But otherwise, where can people find you online to connect with you?
I am on Twitter. I'm at Sean Hamill. Hang on, I have to pick up a copy of my book to see what my actual handles are. They're all printed on the back of the book. On Instagram, I'm also just at Sean Hamill. You can also find me on Facebook. I don't hang out there much, but if that's your social media of choice, just look for my name in front of me. I don't usually say no to anybody unless they're being a jerk. And so far nobody really has. Just wherever you're comfortable reaching out to me. I've got a website. I don't update it very much. But it's got links to, to all this stuff, and to, places where you can get the book, or reach out to me as well if you're interested in giving me a shout. I'm always happy to hear from readers as long as they're nice, that's the caveat. Just be nice. But yeah, I'm always happy to hear from people.
Cool. Well, we will have links to where people can find you, Causing Trouble, on Instagram and Twitter, and where they can find A Cosmology of Monsters, now available in paperback and audiobook. Go check that out. Sean, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's surveillance fatigue has you covered in every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama. From heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up because it's story time.
So even though it's a year later than I had intended, that was our interview with Sean Hamill about A Cosmology of Monsters, which really, really is a compelling book, a compelling story that will draw you in. And now I'm curious to listen to the audiobook, see how that sounds. So there is that. What else do we have? We have a lot of other interviews coming up, spanning horror, sci-fi, space opera, fantasy, and the usual. And maybe a comics writer, and maybe a journalist. Still working on that one. But if you have any questions or comments on stories we've covered or stories you'd like to hear me cover, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976 or shoot me an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. And you can listen to Writers After Dark on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Podcasts, and Player FM. And if you're listening on Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let folks know that you are enjoying this particular podcast, and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Write After Dark. That's WRITE After Dark. And of course, you can find the ever-growing curated list of writer-creator interviews over at youtube.com/sliceofscifi. Just look for the creators and create, I think it's creators and creatives playlist. And of course, there's the website writersafterdark.com where you can find more interviews like this, as well as various reviews for graphic novels, for books, for audiobooks, all sorts of stories that I have found interesting and have managed to actually squeeze out the time to write the reviews for. Come on by, check out the reviews, and you can also weigh in on those reviews with your own rating for them if you don't agree with the ratings that our contributors and myself have come up with. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting Writers After Dark and all the shows in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your donations do really help keep the lights on around here. Every dime, every nickel that's donated or pledged goes to help keep these shows and these websites online. So my heartfelt gratitude goes out to you all. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. If you become a patron, you become eligible for a perk. Every month I pick someone out of the hat and they can choose a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K, or a book, an ARC, a finished paperback, a finished hardcover. Anything that's in the pile of review materials that I have been sent, it's re-gifting, but I'm giving it to my fans and listeners, people who are listening to the show, who are enjoying the shows. And I pass these on to you because I know if you're listening to the show, those things will have a good home. And that's all I need to make me happy. And if you can't commit to a monthly pledge right now, but want to help, the link to use is paypal.me/scifisummer. And again, every little bit helps. So thank you. Thank you all. The music, the theme music to Writers After Dark is provided by Cybin Quest featuring Shade On. You can check out other compositions by them, both collaborative and solo. The links are at the bottom of the website. And that will do it for this episode. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.